Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. On today's podcast, you'll hear a story that comes right out of the horror novels. It involves possession at a national park. We play the chapter that begins the end for our novel, Anything You Can Do. Does Bart have what it takes to face the knife? And what about his twin brother, Martin? Tom is back, and this time we hear about Grandma's food and a neighbor's boat. So, let's get it all going with another 5-Minute Mystery.
Another 5-Minute Mystery.
This 5-Minute Mystery is being brought to you by Misinformation. Have you ever been told something that you truly believe to be true, only to find out that it was incorrect and then you felt lied to on an epic basis? No? Huh. That's truly amazing.
Hello, Emily.
Carl, it's you.
It's reassuring to see that you haven't forgotten me, my dear.
Where have you been all these years, Carl?
Frankly, Emily, I've been trying to lose the memory of our 10 years of marriage. But I must admit, I haven't succeeded.
Go away. Leave this house. This time, never come back.
I have no intentions of returning after this visit, my dear wife. You see, I'm going to kill you.
You're mad.
I really can't resist the situation. It has all the elements. A woman alone in a house in the country, a summer storm, a perfect motive, and an ingenious alibi.
Stay away from me, Carl. Don't touch me!
Don't run away, Emily. Come here.
You must have had quite a ride here in the storm.
Yes, Inspector, but I wanted to report my wife's death as quickly as possible.
I understand you've been away several years.
My wife and I separated 10 years ago.
How'd you happen to come back?
Well, that's rather a strange story, Inspector. It seems that my wife is quite frightened of doctors and refuses to consult them. About 5 days ago, I received a letter from her that she felt she was dying. Well, my wife has always been a strange sort of woman. I hesitate to say it so bluntly, but I'm certain you're aware of the reputation she had here in the village.
No disrespect intended, of course, but she was known as being slightly eccentric.
Yes. By the way, when can you come out to the house to write a report on the suicide?
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to wait till the storm subsides a bit, but I realize you want this whole embarrassing affair disposed of as quickly as possible, so if you'll allow me to have the details, I can begin my report.
Good. Well, I arrived at the house about 8 o'clock tonight. I found my wife in her bedroom. She was bleeding from several small wounds. She told me that they were self-inflicted.
Didn't you stop the bleeding?
Yes, but she only laughed and said there was nothing I could do. You see, she revealed to me that she suffered from hemophilia. It would be impossible to stop the flow of blood. There were too many wounds.
The storm seems to be letting up. I think we'll be able to make it to the house now. I must warn you that anything you say will be used against you in your trial. I'm accusing you of the murder of your wife.
What flaw did the inspector find in Carl's story? In just a moment, we'll know, but first...
Quite the creepy and gruesome opening on this one. That guy sure did hold a grudge, and boy... that was some alibi. I am glad to see that the inspector was not fooled by it, but what was it that tipped him off? I think it might be the whole hemophilia thing. What do you say we go find out?
And now, back to our story.
Carl, you murdered your wife, and with one of the most gruesome methods I've ever encountered. Your story stamped itself as a lie when you told me your wife said she suffered from hemophilia. For your information, my friend, women never suffer from the affliction of hemophilia. They may transmit it to male members of their family by means of heredity, but they themselves are never affected by it. The blood on your hands won't wash off easily.
Well, there you have it, the misinformation that I spoke of. Women can have the dreaded disease of hemophilia. So the detective is wrong. While it is quite rare in women, if both parents have it, it can be passed to a daughter. However, in this case, we know the guy did it because we heard it. And I, for one, hope that justice is done. This mystery was brought to you by Misinformation. This week, I have to say that we're closing in to the end of our story, Anything You Can Do. With it looming, Wanda Snyder from Toronto asks this question. Hello, Ron. Thank you for the podcast. I love science fiction, and I am enjoying Anything You Can Do. When we took a break from it during the month of October, it was all I could do to stop myself from going to listen to the rest of it. Now that we're back on track, I'm excited for it to end. What will happen after we finish the book? My vote is for more science fiction. I think it's a good fit to your show, Wanda. Well, thank you, Wanda. I too have been enjoying Anything You Can Do, and judging by the mail, you and I are not the only ones. I have been looking for the next thing we will be listening to on the podcast, and to be honest, I'm not sure what that will be. A lot of people love the old-time radio, and a lot of you love the serialized idea of listening to a book. I do know that I will be looking for more science fiction, maybe in the form of a novella. For those of you who don't know, a novella is basically just a shorter novel. I've also toyed with the idea of writing my own stories and presenting them here. Whatever happens next, I promise you, it will be amazing. One of the things I'm looking into is an idea suggested to me from Mark Lopez. Mark wrote, "Hi Ron, I love your podcast and never miss an episode. I discovered that many of Philip K. Dick's works are in the public domain and are featured on LibriVox. One of my favorite stories by him is Second Variety. I think you and all my fellow listeners will like it. It scared the heck out of me. Please keep up the good work. Regards, Mark Lopez." Well, Mark, this is a strong contender for the show. It plays out in 4 30-minute parts, which fits the category of the novella. It was first published in Space Science Fiction in May of 1953 and is a classic Philip K. Dick story. Also, it has the distinction of being certified public domain. I guess my question is to all of you. What do you think about this, and what do you want to hear on the podcast? I'm open to all ideas and suggestions. Head to ronsamazingstories.com and leave your comment there, or better yet, head to our Facebook page and let's start a conversation there. Go to Facebook and search for Ron's Amazing Stories. I want this podcast to be your podcast. My thanks to Wanda and Mark for the great questions. And now, these are your stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
The story this week comes from Tony Stangert from California. I first received what I thought was a good story from Tony, but I thought it was missing some elements. After a few emails, I got the rest of it, and what started out as a good story is now pretty epic. Hey, Ron, I'm a double major in electrical engineering and accounting with a minor in computer science. I did this so that I would never have to write a paper. So, as a result, I'm not a writer. I'm sending you my story, so please do your magic if you decide to use it. Tony. Well, after several emails and a few questions, I did take this project on, and here is Tony's story. In 2001, I was visiting a girlfriend in Monterey Bay. Karen and I decided to visit an art museum where they were presenting the works of the famous photographer Ansel Adams. The photos were from his historic venture into Yosemite National Park. His art simply took our breath away, especially when you consider the pictures were taken in 1927. At that time, I was a free spirit, and I convinced Karen that we should just go there and see for ourselves. Yosemite is about 160 miles away, and we arrived at the park at dusk. There was not much available for lodging, but we did find this crappy motel about 20 minutes outside the park. The area had a few businesses, motels, a couple restaurants, a liquor store, and a gas station. All the buildings were separate and freestanding. However, I could not see a single residence. It was very odd for me, having been raised in Washington, D.C. It felt odd that there were no residents around. The motel was a drive-up-to-the-door type and was very outdated. Two things stood out in my memory: the floor model TV that was still in black and white, and the strange bathroom that had cedar outdoor siding surrounding the tub. There was one other thing, and that is just how creepy the whole place was. At first, the novelty of it all was fun. But then at 2 o'clock in the morning, we were fleeing our room. We had just finished setting up for the night and decided to head out for dinner and drinks. It was a small town, no more than 50 people, but there were places open. We ate dinner, had some fun, but wanted to be ready for a full day of exploring the park, so we headed back to the motel early. Back at the motel, we both had issues falling asleep, even though we were exhausted from the trip. I turned on the old black-and-white TV to find a classic episode of Kojak playing. Finally, at around 11, we dozed off. At precisely 2 a.m., the both of us woke up, sat up in bed in terror and pain. Neither one of us was clear on what had just occurred, but we knew we had to leave, and leave now. We grabbed our stuff, shot out of the room, and headed to the car. The motel office was closed, so I threw the keys at the door as we left. About a half an hour later, we were parked at the Yosemite sign in a little pull-off. We then both described the same experience. A very angry, short man with long gray hair and even longer beard was yelling about some woman. He was dressed in dungy overalls and had no shoes. He somehow subdued us and put his hand into the center of our backs while we slept. This felt like a possession. It was so painful that we both could still feel it even after we left the motel. Karen was not in my dream, and I wasn't in hers. The physical pain lasted about 15 minutes for both of us. To this day, I'm not sure what we experienced, but I do know I will never go back. We slept in the car at that pull-off until the first bit of light woke us up. Sleep-deprived and blurry-eyed, we made our way home. I remember driving past one of the cliffs we saw in the museum. Our perspective was much different than that of Ansel Adams. From our view, we were mostly just under it. But we were satisfied, and our goal was achieved. At the first bit of civilization, we got a room at a real hotel. Let's say, Holiday Inn. We grabbed a six-pack, some fast food, and watched a color television. We went to sleep early that night, but sleep for us was messed up for a couple days. We got up early and drove to San Francisco for a full day of tourist stuff. I've attached a picture that was taken just after our nap at that little pull-up near Yosemite National Park. Sorry, it is a picture of a picture. Anthony Stangert, California. What an amazing story, Tony. So freaky, and it sent chills down my spine. I have no idea how you must have felt and how you dealt with it all. You said in your last note that this story was cathartic for you. I'm happy for that, but I'm left with so many questions. Also, you said you had more stories. Please do send them in. We want to hear them. If you have a story like Tony, and you want to send it in, I'll read it, or you can read it yourself. All you have to do is go to ronsamazingstories.com, click on the story submission banner, type away, and the next thing you know, your story will be told on the podcast. Do it today because we really do want to hear your story. Thank you, Tony.
Welcome back, sci-fi fans. We've taken a little break, but now it's time for more of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. When we left, Colonel Mannheim had been eaten by the Knipe. Bart Stanton had had a psychotic break, disappeared, and then returned to the Knipe Project. And Mannheim's replacement was none other than Stanley Martin, Bart's long-lost twin brother and master detective of the asteroid belt. And now, Chapter 19 of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
From the very moment he had heard that Stanley Martin had arrived to take charge of the project, Bart Stanton pushed all thoughts of his brother out of his mind. He had fouled up once by thinking of himself rather than thinking of what had to be done. He would not make that mistake again. Nor, apparently, did Martin have any desire to meet Bart Stanton. He took control of the project smoothly. Apparently, Mannheim had taken into account the possibility of his own death and had arranged things accordingly. Although Martin was not a member of the World Police, his own record showed that he had the ability to handle the job, and an executive session had unanimously accepted Colonel Mannheim's wishes in the matter. There was little else they could do. The very fact that Mannheim had died in the way he had, ordering the guard to hold his fire, had stilled those voices on the Executive Council who had been wavering before. Martin had come into Earth almost secretly, without fanfare, and the general public was totally unaware that anything at all had happened. Special messages, going through the channels known to be tapped by the Knipe, said that it would not be in the public interest to admit that the Knipe could actually penetrate the defenses of World Police Headquarters. So the Knipe was not surprised when the public news channels announced quietly that Colonel Walther Mannheim, the man who had been decorated 12 years before for the quelling of the Central Brazilian insurrection, had died peacefully in his sleep. The funeral was quiet, but with full honors. Stanton stopped worrying about such things. Until he had done the job that he had been rebuilt for, he was determined to make that goal his sole purpose. As the weeks sped by, he kept determinedly to his regime, exercising regularly to keep himself in top physical condition, and studying the three-dimensional motion studies of the Knipe in action. Only one of these made him ill the first time he watched it, but it was the only recording of the Knipe actually in the process of killing a man, so he watched, over and over again, the shots taken from the gun tower when the Knipe attacked Colonel Mannheim. A full-sized mock-up of the Knipe's body had been built, with the best approximation possible of the knife's bone structure and musculature, and Stanton worked with it to determine what, if any, were the knife's physical limitations. His only periods of relative relaxation occurred when he discussed the psychological peculiarities of the knife mind with George Yoritomo. One afternoon, after a particularly strenuous boxing session, he walked into Yoritomo's office with a grin on his face. "I've been considering the problem of the apparent paradox of a high technology in a ritual taboo system." Yoritomo grinned back delightedly and waved Stanton to a chair. "Excellent. It is always much better if the student thinks these things out for himself. Now, while I fill this hand furnace with tobacco and fire up, you will please explain to me all about it." Stanton sat down and settled himself comfortably. "All right. In the first place, there's the notion of religion. In tribal cultures, the religion is usually, animistic, I think the word is." Yoritomo nodded silently. "They believe there are spirits everywhere," Stanton said. "That sort of belief, it seems to me, would grow up in any race that had imagination, and the Knipes must have plenty of that, or they wouldn't have the technology that we know they do have. Am I on the right track?" "Very good, very good," Yoritomo said in approval. "But what evidence have you that this technology was not given to them by some other, more advanced race?" "I hadn't thought of that." Stanton stared into space for a moment, then nodded his head. "Of course, it would take too long to teach them. It wouldn't be worth all the trouble it would take to make them unlearn their fallacies and learn the new facts. It would take generations to do it, unless this hypothetical other race killed off all the adult Knipes and started the little ones off fresh. And that didn't happen, because if it had, the ritual taboo system would have died out too. So that other race theory is out." "The argument is imperfect," Yoritomo said, "but it will suffice for the moment. Go on about the religion." "Okay. Religious beliefs are not subject to pragmatic tests. That is, the spiritual beliefs aren't. Any belief that could be disproven by such a test would eventually die out. But beliefs in ghosts or demons or angels or life after death aren't disprovable by material tests, any more than they are provable. So, as a race increases its knowledge of the physical world, its religion would tend to become more and more spiritual." "Agreed. Yes, it happens so among human beings," said Yoritomo. "But how do you link this fact with ritual taboo?" "Well, once a belief gains a foothold," Stanton said, "it is very difficult to wipe it out, even among human beings. Among Knipes, it would be well nigh impossible. Once a code of ritual and of social behavior had been set up, it became permanent." "For example?" Yoritomo urged. "Well, shaking hands, for example," Stanton said after a pause. "We still do that, even if we don't have it fixed solidly in our heads that we must do it. I suppose it would never occur to a Knipe not to perform such a ritual." "Just so," Yoritomo agreed vigorously. "Such things, once established in the minds of the race, would tend to remain. But it is a characteristic of a ritual taboo system that it resists change. Change is evil. Change is wrong. We must use what we know to be true, not try something that has never been tried before. In a ritual taboo system, a thing which is not ritual is, ipso facto, taboo. How then can we account for their high technological achievements?" "The pragmatic engineering approach, I imagine," Stanton said. "If a thing works, then go ahead and use it. It is usable. If not, it isn't." "Approximately," said Yoritomo. "But only approximately. Now it is my turn to lecture." He put his pipe in an ashtray and held up a long, bony finger. "Firstly, we must remember that the Knipe is equipped with a functioning imagination. Secondly, he has in his memory a tremendous amount of data, already at hand. He is capable of working out theories in his head, you see. Like the ancient Greeks, he finds no need to test such theories, unless his thinking indicates that such an experiment would yield something useful. Unlike the Greeks, he has no aversion to experiment, but he sees no need for useless experiment either. Oh, he would learn, yes. But once a given theory proved workable, how resistant he would be to a new theory. Innovators, even in our own culture, have a very hard time working against the great inertia of a recognized theory. How much harder it would be in a ritual taboo society with a perfect memory. How long, how incredibly long, it would take such a race to achieve the technology the Nipe now has. Hundreds of thousands of years, said Stanton. Yoritomo shook his head briskly. Pah! Longer! Much longer! He smiled with satisfaction. I estimate that the Nipe race first invented the steam engine not less than 10 million years ago. He kept smiling into the dead silence that followed. After a long minute, Stanton said, What about atomic energy? At least 2 million years ago, Yoritomo said. I do not think they have had the interstellar drive more than some 50,000 years. No wonder our pet Nipe is so patient, Stanton said with a touch of awe in his voice. How long do you suppose their individual lifespan is? Not so long in comparison, said Yoritomo. Perhaps no longer than our own at the least, or perhaps as much as 500 years. Considering the tremendous handicaps against them, they have done quite well, I think. Quite well indeed, for a race of illiterate cannibals. How's that again? Stanton realized that the scientist was quite serious. Hadn't it occurred to you, my friend, that they must be cannibals? Yoritomo asked. And that they must be very nearly illiterate? No, Stanton admitted. It hadn't. The Nipe, like man, is omnivorous, Yoritomo pointed out. Specialization tends to lead any race up a blind alley, and dietary restrictions are a particularly pernicious form of specialization. A lion would starve to death in a wheat field. A horse would perish in a butcher shop full of steaks. A man will survive as long as there is something around to eat, even if it's another man. Yoritomo picked up his pipe and began tapping the ashes out of it. Also, he went on, we must remember that man, early in his career of becoming top dog on Earth, began using a method of removing the unfit. Ritual traces of it remain today in some societies, the Jewish bar mitzvah, for instance, or the Christian confirmation. Before and immediately after the Holocaust, there were still primitive societies on Earth, in New Guinea, for instance, which still made a rather hard ordeal out of the rite of passage, their ceremony whereby a boy becomes a man, if he passes the tests. Yoritomo was filling his pipe, a look of somber satisfaction on his lean face. A few millennia ago, a boy who underwent those tests was killed outright if he failed, and was eaten. He had not shown the ability to overrule with reason his animal instincts. Therefore, he was not a human being, but an animal. What better use for a young and succulent animal than to provide meat for the common larder? "And you think the same process must have been used by the Nipes?" Stanton asked. Yoritomo nodded vigorously as he applied a match flame to the tobacco in his pipe. The Nipe race must, of necessity, have had some similar ritualistic tests, or they would not have become what they are. He said when he had puffed the pipe alight, and we have already agreed that once the Nipes adopted something of that kind, it remained with them. Not so? Yes. Also, it can be considered extremely unlikely that the Nipe civilization, if such it can be called, has any geriatric problem. No, indeed. No old age pensions, no old folks' homes, no senility. No, nor any specialists in geriatrics either. When a Nipe becomes a burden because of age, he is ritually murdered and eaten with all due solemnity. Yoritomo pointed his pipe stem at Stanton. Ah, you frown, my friend. Have I made them sound heartless without the finer feelings of which we humans are so proud? Not so. When Junior Knipe fails his puberty tests, when Mama and Papa Knipe are sent to their final reward, I have no doubt that there is sadness in the hearts of their loved ones as the honored T-bones are passed around the table. He put the pipe back in his mouth and spoke around it. My own ancestors, not too far back, performed a ritual suicide by disemboweling themselves with a long, sharp knife. Across the abdomen, so, and up into the heart, so. It was considered very bad form to faint or die before the job was done. Nearby, a relative or close friend stood with a sharp sword to administer the coup de grace by decapitation. It was all very sad and very honorable. Their loved ones bore the sorrow with great pride. His voice, which had been low and tender, suddenly became very brisk. Thank goodness it has gone out of fashion. But how can you be sure they're cannibals? Stanton asked. Your argument sounds logical enough, but you can't be basing your theory on that alone. True, true. Yoritomo jabbed the air twice with a rapid forefinger. Evidence for such a theory would be most welcome, would it not? Very well, I give you the evidence. He eats human beings, our Knipe. That doesn't make him a cannibal, Stanton objected. Not strictly, perhaps, but consider. The Knipe is not a monster. He is not a criminal. No, he is a gentleman. He always behaves as a gentleman. He is shipwrecked on an alien planet. Around him, he sees evidence in profusion that ours is a technological society. But that is a contradiction, a paradox. For we are not civilized. No, we are not rational. We are not sane. We do not obey the laws. We do not perform the rituals. We are animals, apparently intelligent animals, but animals nevertheless. How can this be? Ha! Says the Knipe to himself, these animals must be ruled over by real people. It is the only explanation. Not so? Colonel Mannheim mentioned that, Stanton said. Are you implying that the Knipe thinks there are other Knipes around, running the world from secret hideouts, like the villains in a Fu Manchu novel? Not quite, said Yoritomo, laughing. The Knipe is not at all incapable of learning something new. In point of fact, he is quite good at it, as witness the fact that he has learned many Earth languages. He picked up Russian in less than 8 months simply by listening and observing. Like our own race, his undoubtedly evolved a great many languages during the beginnings of its progress, when there were many tribes, separated and out of communication with each other. It would not surprise me to find that most of these languages have survived, and that our distressed astronaut knows them all. A new language would not bother him in the least. Nor would, strangely, shaped intelligent beings make him unhappy. His race should be aware, by now, that such things must exist. But it is very likely that he equates true intelligence with technology, and I do not think it likely that he has ever met a race higher than the barbarian level before. Such races were not, of course, human, by his definition. They showed possibilities, perhaps, but they had not by any means evolved far enough. And considering the time span involved in their own progress toward a technological civilization, it is not at all unlikely that the Knipe thinks of technology as something that evolves in a race in the same way that intelligence does, or the body itself. So, it would not surprise him to find that the real people of this system were humanoid in shape, instead of, Knipoid? A bad word, but it will do for the nonce. To find real people of a different shape is something new, but he can absorb it because it does not contradict anything he knows. But any truly intelligent being that did not obey the law and follow the ritual would be a contradiction in terms. For our Knipe has no notion of a real person without those characteristics. Without those characteristics, technology is, of course, utterly impossible. Since he sees technology all around him, it follows that there must be real people around somewhere that have those characteristics. Anything else is unthinkable. It seems to me that you're building an awfully involved theory out of pretty flimsy stuff, Stanton said. Yoritomo shook his head. Not at all, not at all. Every scrap and shred of evidence we have points toward it. Why, do you suppose, does the Knipe conscientiously devour his victims, often risking his own safety to do so? Why do you suppose he never uses any weapon but his own hands to kill with? Yoritomo leaned forward and speared out at Stanton with a long, bony forefinger. Why? To tell the real people that he is a gentleman. He sat back with a satisfied smile and puffed complacently at his pipe, remaining silent while Bart Stanton considered his last remark. Just one thing, Stanton said after a minute. It seems to me that he would be able to judge that some races have different laws and rituals than he does. Wouldn't they have a science comparable to our own anthropology? Yoritomo grinned. Nipology, shall we say? Well, he might, but it would not tell him what our anthropology tells us. Consider. How have we learned much of our knowledge of the early history of man? By the study of ritual taboo cultures, the so-called primitive cultures. It is from these tribes that we have learned the multifarious ways in which a group of human beings can evolve a culture and a society. But does the Knipe have any such other tribes to study? Why wouldn't he? Stanton asked. Because there are none, Yoritomo said. How could there be? Consider again. Once a race has evolved a fairly high technological level, it is capable of wiping out races which have not achieved that level. If the technologically advanced tribe is still at the ritual taboo level, it will consider that all tribes which do not use the same laws and rituals as it does must be animals, dangerous animals that must be wiped out. Take a look at the history of our own race. In a few short centuries, we find that the technologically advanced civilization and culture of Renaissance Europe has spread over the whole globe. By military, economic, and religious conquest, it has, in effect, westernized the majority of mankind. The same process would take place on the Knipe's world, only more thoroughly. The weaker tribes would vanish, the stronger would amalgamate. That process would take a lot of time, Stanton said. Indeed, oh yes, indeed, Yoritomo agreed. But they have had the time, have they not, eh? What Western European man has partially achieved in less than 1,000 years, surely the Knipe equivalent could have achieved in 10,000,000, eh? But I think that the Knipe would have realized, after 10 years, that there is no such race of real people, Stanton said. He's had access to our records and books and such things, or does he reject them all as lies? Possibly he would, if he could read them, Yoritomo said. Did I not say he was illiterate? You mean he's learned to speak our languages but not to read them? The psychologist smiled broadly. Your statement is accurate, my friend, but incomplete. It is my opinion that the Knipe is incapable of reading any written language whatever. The concept does not exist in his mind except vaguely. Stanton closed one eye and gave Yoritomo the glance askance. Aw, come on, George! A technological race without a written language? That's impossible! Ah, no, no it isn't. Ask yourself. What need has a race with a perfect memory for written records? At least in the sense that we think of them. Certainly not to remember things. What would a Knipe need with a memorandum book or a diary? All of their history and all of their technology exists in the collective mind of the race. Think for a moment of their history. If it is somewhat analogous to human history, and as we have seen, there is reason to believe that this is so, then we can, in a way, trace the development of writing. Wait a minute, Stanton held up his hand. I think I see what you're driving at. Ah, so? Yoritomo nodded. Very well, then you expound. I can give it to you in 2 sentences, Stanton said. One, their first writing was probably pictographic, and was learned only by a select priestly class. Two, it still is. Ah! Yoritomo's eyes lit up. Admirable! Most admirable! And succinctly put, too. And to top it off, almost precisely correct. That is what happened here on Earth. Are we wrong in assuming that such may have happened elsewhere in the universe? Remembering always, my dear Bart, that we must not make the mistake of thinking like our friend, the Knipe, and assuming that everybody else in the universe has to be like us in all things. You are correct. That is why I hedged when I said he was almost illiterate. There is a possibility that a written symbology does exist for Knipes, but it is used almost entirely for ritualistic purposes. It is pictographical in form, and is known only to a very few. For others to learn it would be taboo. Remember, I said that there is only one society, one culture remaining on the Knipe planet. And remember that history is a very late development in our own culture, just as written language is. One important event in every 10 centuries of Knipe history would still give a Knipe historian 10,000 events to remember just since the invention of the steam engine. What, then, does Knipe history become? A series of folk chants, of chansons de geste. Why? Stanton asked. If they have perfect memories, why would histories be distorted? Time, my dear boy, time. Yoritomo spread his hands in a gesture of futility. When one has a few million years of history to learn, it must become distorted, even in a race with a perfect memory. Otherwise, no individual would have a chance to learn it all in a single lifetime, even a lifetime of 500 years, much less to pass that knowledge on to another. So only the most important events are reported. And that means that each historian must also be an editor. He must excise those portions which he considers unimportant. But wouldn't that very limitation induce them to record history? Stanton asked. Right there is your inducement to use a written language. Yoritomo looked at him with wide-eyed innocence. Why? What good is history? Oh, said Stanton, I see. Certainly you do, Yoritomo said firmly. Of what use is history to the ritual taboo culture? Only to record what is to be done. And with a memory that can know what is to be done, of what use is a historian, except to remember the important things? No ritual taboo culture looks upon history as we do. Only the doings of the great are recorded. All else must be edited out. Thus, while the memory of the individual may be, and is, perfect, the memory of the race is not. But they don't know that. What about communications, then? Stanton asked. What did they use before they invented radio? Couriers, Yoritomo said, and possibly written messages from one priestly scribe to another. That last, by the way, has probably survived in a ritualistic form. When an officer is appointed to a post, let's say, he may get a formal paper that says so. The Knipes may use symbols to signify rank and so on. They must have a symbology for a calibration of scientific instruments. But none of these requires the complexity of a written language. I dare say our use of it is quite baffling to him. For teaching purposes, it is quite unnecessary. Look at what television and such have done in our own civilization. With such tools as that at hand, recordings and pictures, it is possible to teach a person a great many things without ever teaching him to read. A Knipe certainly wouldn't need any aid for calculation, would he? We humans must use a piece of paper to multiply 2 10-digit numbers together, but that's because our memories are faulty. A Knipe has no need for such aids. Are you really positive of all this, George? Stanton asked. Yoritomo shrugged. How can we be absolutely positive at this stage of the game, eh? Our evidence is sketchy, I admit. It is not as solidly based as our other reconstructions of his background, but it appears that he thinks of symbols as being unable to convey much information. The pattern for his raids, for instance, indicates that his knowledge of the materials he wants and their locations comes from vocal sources, television advertising, eavesdropping on shipping orders, and so on. In other words, he cases the joint by ear. If he could understand written information, his job would be much easier. He could find his materials much more quickly and easily. And, too, we have never seen him either read a word or write one. From this evidence, we are fairly certain that he can neither read nor write any terrestrial language, or even his own. He spread his hands again. As I said, it's not proof. No, Stanton agreed. But I must admit that the whole thing makes for some very interesting speculation, doesn't it? Very interesting indeed. Yoritomo folded his hands in his lap, smiled seraphically, and looked at the ceiling. In fact, my friend, we are now so positive of our knowledge of the Knipe's mind that we are prepared to enter into the next phase of our program. Oh? Stanton distinctly felt the back of his neck prickle. Yes, said Yoritomo. Mr. Martin feels that if we wait much longer, we may run into the danger of giving the Knipe enough time to complete his work on his communicator. He looked at Stanton and chuckled, but there was no humor in his short laugh. We would not wish our friend, the Knipe, to bring his relatives into this little tussle, would we, Bart? That's been our deadline all along, Bart said levelly. The object all along has been to let the Knipe work without hindrance as long as he did not actually produce a communicator that would, as you put it, bring his relatives into the tussle. Have things changed? They have, Yoritomo acknowledged. Why wouldn't they? We have been working toward that as a final deadline. If it appeared that the Knipe were actually about to contact his confederates out there somewhere, we would be forced to act immediately, of course. Plan Beta would go into effect. But we don't want that, do we? No, said Stanton. No. He was well aware what a terrible loss it would be for humanity if Plan Beta went into effect. The Knipe would have to be literally blasted out of his cozy little nest. No, of course not. Yoritomo chuckled again, with as little mirth as he had before. Within a very short while, if we are correct, we shall, with your help, arrest the most feared arch-criminal that Earth has ever known. I dare say that the public will be extremely happy to hear of his death, and I know that the rest of us will be happy to know that he will never kill again. Stanton suddenly saw the fateful day for which he had been so carefully prepared and trained, looming terrifyingly large in the immediate future. How soon? He asked in an oddly choked voice. Within days. Yoritomo lowered his eyes from the ceiling and looked into Stanton's face with a mild, bland expression. Tomorrow, he said, the propaganda phase begins. We will announce to the world that the great detective, Stanley Martin, has come to Earth to rid us of the Knipe.
And that concludes Chapter 19. Be sure to come back next time for more of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
As read by Amazing Stories, read by Amazing People.
This time on As Read By, we continue growing up with Tom Williams. Tom lives in Berlin, Germany, was raised in Alabama, and has sent in these tales from his youth. This time, Tom thinks back to the days of the tenpenny nail in a story he calls
Growing Up, Bremel, Food, and Boats. Grandmother wasn't as strict as our parents were, which was the one of many reasons the grandkids left to go spend the nights at Grandma's house on the weekend. The old big house was a bit too big for her later on in her years, so Dad and a friend of family, Mr. Frank, started building a smaller house on the back property. I remember Dad handing me a dollar to go down to the store and get a dollar's worth of 10-penny nails. I never knew what a 10-penny nail was, but maybe someone will tell me one day. Get back here and don't play around, boy. Once completed, she had her chickens fenced in the back, and my aunt later put a small house trailer back there where we kids were allowed to stay up well past midnight playing Monopoly. No one ever complained. Grandmother was a kind soul and always told me stories of her youth. Once I was sitting in the front porch swing looking a little down, she came out and asked what was wrong. Why such a long face? Well, I told her how ugly I was with all those freckles. Oh, don't you worry about those freckles, Tommy. One day they will go away and you're going to break some girl's heart. Nice try, Grandma, I thought. Then I got a severe sunburn. No one warned us about that stuff as we were growing up, as kids. It was bad, I mean real bad. Water blisters and all. I remember laying there with cold rags to ease the pain. Then my skin began to peel off. There was still one hope for me in those freckles, though. In my daydreaming, I remember seeing caterpillars shed and out came a butterfly. It was called metamorphosis. I shed skin for a long time, but sadly discovered that metamorphosis doesn't apply to children. It didn't help a bit. I still had those stupid freckles. Kids think the darndest things. I must say that Grandma was right, though. It took a few years longer than I wanted, but no more freckles. Thanks, Grandma. Ask any of the grandkids. Grandma could cook and bake. She made the best coconut cream pies and banana pudding and peach cobblers. Nothing out of the box, mind you. All from scratch. And she'd always ask us kids, what do you kids want this weekend? And there was a general consensus sometimes. I love the banana pudding with vanilla wafers. Others liked coconut cream pie. Others liked the peach cobblers or apple cobblers. It really didn't matter. It was all delicious. When it came to food, we would go over the bay and by the way of the causeway and buy a bushel of peaches or 100-pound sack of potatoes all for a dollar and a little bit of labor. A lot of things cost a dollar those days. We'd go to the shrimp boats with a wash tub and bring back fresh shrimp out of the Gulf for a cookout. Then Dad would sometimes stop by the banana boats out of South America and buy a stalk of green bananas, and we'd hang the stalk out on the back porch, and as they ripened, we always had our treat. The cost? He only paid $1 for a whole stalk. We never had to really buy fish because we could go fishing. And the license? Well, at that time, it was much more simple. If you fished with a cane pole or just threw a line in with a hook and bobber, no license was required. Only if you cast away further from the shore with a reel and rod. If we couldn't dig worms on our property, my uncle and I would go to the junkyard and turn over junk and voila, all the worms you can use. I'd like to correct myself at this point right now because I mentioned that we didn't have to buy fish. Well, we didn't, but sometimes we went out on the causeway to one of the several seafood restaurants out there, and yes, another dollar. You always got a heaping plate full of cooked shrimp or beer-battered fried flounder. I still remember the sign over the door. It read, "The seafood you eat here today slept last night in the bay." Over 65 years ago, and I still remember that sign. Mr. Frank, a friend of the family, had taken a whole year to build his fishing boat from scratch. At last, the proud man called Dad over to admire his handiwork and asked Dad if he would help install a car motor that he had gotten somewhere. Dad was an expert with things like that, and he said he would help. With long hours and skinned knuckles, they got the inboard motor installed with a warning several times. Many times I heard my dad say, "Mr. Frank, you've built that inboard motor mount much too high." Dad worked all of his life at the shipyard, at the docks, and knew what he was saying. But Mr. Frank was in a hurry and didn't want to wait any longer. He wanted to get that boat into the water. Finishing up, Mr. Frank got the boat on the trailer, and we all headed to the river at the fishing camp. And they got the boat into the water okay, and as they stood there with big grins on their faces, suddenly the boat bobbed for a few minutes, and I should say a couple of seconds, and then it slowly rolled over bottoms up. Dad looked at me, he and I got into the car, and as we drove away, he shouted out of the open window, "I told you, Mr. Frank, it's all yours now," as we drove off in a cloud of dust. So as the old German seamen say, may there always be a hand width of water underneath your keel. Sincerely yours, Tommy.
Thank you, Tom. So today is your lucky day. I'm about to tell you what a tenpenny nail is. Hold on to your seat because it truly is amazing. The term penny nail originated in medieval times and is believed to describe the number of English pennies required to purchase 100 nails. In the 15th century, 100 sixpenny nails cost a sixpence, 100 eightpenny nails cost an eightpence, and so on, so that the larger the number, the longer the nail. How about that? Now, to wrap this up, a 10-penny nail is actually about 3 inches long, 7.6 centimeters. So there you have the origin of the 10-penny nail. My thanks to Tom for sending in his stories each week. It's a pleasure to hear these tales from our past, and more importantly, hear them from Tom. Next up, we grow up with parents. Includes this one, and I want to thank Wanda Snyder, Mark Lopez, Anthony Stangert, Mark Nelson, and of course, Tom Williams. Next week, we're going to have a special podcast. It will have at least 2 chapters of Anything You Can Do, and it's going to allow me to take a break for Thanksgiving. It's my hope that your week is full of family, love, and happiness. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you'll find all of the links you'll need. Please leave reviews and feedback about the show. It really does help us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.